So let me get to the interview now. Again, you can follow me on Facebook and on Twitter. And we do this every weeknight. Here we go. 9 p.m. Eastern Time on blogtalkradio.com and on Facebook Live. So I got this thing in the email because I check my inbox from time to time, and there was this organization saying that they wanted to come on the show and kind of talk with us about legalizing weed. But it's not just a typical weed group. It's actually a lawyer group, like a law firm in Cleveland, of all places. And I thought, well, what the heck? This is kind of weird. And it read the THC Legal Group. And I've got apparently all these lawyers who deal with all the different aspects of weed. And I thought, gosh, isn't that interesting? Because I thought weed was illegal, like possessing it or using it, distributing it or selling it. It all are like federal crimes, unless, of course, you happen to be the daughter of the president of the United States, and then nobody seems to care. But I thought, well, this can't be right. I certainly don't understand, because if all of this stuff is illegal, why on earth is there a law firm specializing in all of this stuff? And again, I'm a high school guy. I barely graduated from high school, if I'm going to be brutally honest about this. So what do I know? So I thought, all right, let me reach out to this firm and see if I can find someone there who not only knows what he's talking about, which is like really important if you're going to have him as a guest, but also can speak in a language so simple that even I can understand what the hell he's talking about. And so I reached out to this big deal law firm in Cleveland, and I said, you know, do you have somebody like that? And they said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we do. Our chief operating officer is a guy named Abe Cohn, and he understands all about the different ins and outs of all the laws regarding marijuana, weed, you know, whatever it happens to be, and would you like to have him as a guest? And I said, well, heck yeah, but, you know, so let's see if we can, you know, work this out and see if he can explain to me what on earth is going on, because I thought all this stuff was illegal. So they said, okay, fine, we'll do it. Well, turns out they did do it. So, Abe Cohn, welcome to One Dimitri Radio. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me. This is very exciting for me and of course, THC Legal Group.
All right. Now, question. I thought it was against federal law to possess, use, distribute, sell marijuana, and yet you've got an organization here that actually does this. Help me understand.
Right. So, you know, the key to remember is that the United States really is governed by two different sets of laws. There is federal law, and then there is state law. So certainly under the federal law, marijuana or cannabis, as its technical term, is considered to be a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substance Act. So that means, as you rightly noted, selling it, smoking it, you know, all of the typical things you would imagine a person would want to do with it, yes, it's illegal under federal law. But in certain states, we have schemas where you are either allowed to use marijuana for medicinal purposes. In Ohio, for example, we just passed a law in June, which will become kind of fully implemented sometime mid-September, which says that if you are, in fact, a patient who has legitimate needs for cannabis and you get the proper authorization from a bona fide doctor, then you're allowed to use it. So whether or not something is illegal or legal really depends on what part of the country you're in.
All right. Now, you mentioned a word, and I'm not quite sure I understood it. Schema?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, you know, a schema, just some sort of legal framework that dictates how a person goes about, you know, interacting with a specific set of marijuana laws. So different states have different regimens. You could either be in a state where marijuana is fully legal on a commercial level, or in certain states, it's only medicinally legal, rather.
All right. And again, I'm confused because the federal law says all of this is illegal, and yet you're saying
right,
states can disobey the federal law. I'm really confused. I mean, I'm no lawyer, so help me understand.
Yeah.
What is this? How can it be both?
Right. This is the fundamental problem. You know, under the Constitution, there is a doctrine called the Supremacy Clause, which means that when you have a state law conflicting with the federal law is supposed to trump the state law.
Right.
That's kind of in theory how it's supposed to work. But of course, in the real world, that's not always how it plays out. And we're seeing a huge power struggle between state rights and federal rights. And it's a very challenging, confusing topic. You know, power really comes down to enforcement. And so in this case, the question now is really not whether or not the federal law says that you are or are not allowed to do something, but whether or not the federal government will actually send in policemen, you know, troops, enforcement officers to make sure that you don't do it.
Well, they do that a lot. I mean, I'm a libertarian, so I see it like all the time. They send their stormtroopers in and screw over people's lives. So why aren't they doing it now with weed?
Well, you know, it depends. Certainly under the Obama administration, we have memos being circulated suggesting that the administration has instructed the DEA to kind of take it easy, don't get too involved. And this is kind of the conflict. How could it be that the law says X and in reality it doesn't quite work that way?
Right.
You know, this is the nature of the world. You know, we have laws, but that doesn't mean the government, just like a police officer doesn't necessarily have to arrest you if he sees you speeding, that certainly doesn't mean that speeding is legal. But it just means that those same officers have been directed to kind of allocate their resources maybe to perceived better sources of problems. And
yeah,
that's kind of what we're seeing here.
Yeah, well, that certainly helps me. I'm a white male, so I've got white privilege, so he's not going to be arresting me for a broken taillight. Thank God for that anyway. So give me a background here about marijuana, weed, cannabis. On your website, it was mostly cannabis, but most people call it weed or marijuana. Give me like a big picture thing. This is a plant that, as far as I know, never hurt anyone. So when did it first become like a dangerous plant, an outlaw plant? When did that happen?
Right. There's an interesting history about this. You know, I don't quite remember the year, but cannabis or marijuana was illegal, originally kind of brought to the forefront as a dangerous substance by, I believe, the FBI in the mid-1930s. Many people suspected that this kind of spotlight on the plant was a cynical attempt to regulate kind of issues of immigration and other sort of broader policy concerns. But you know, it's an interesting question. I think it's a cultural question and an anthropological question. The herb itself has kind of been associated with a lifestyle, a counterculture. People think of hippies, of lazy people, and the media has certainly, I think, been complicit in furthering the stereotype. But over the years, you know, we see different generations having stronger or lesser affinities for cannabis. And where we currently stand, the younger generations are making their way to the voting booths, and it's shifting once again, and people are becoming less tolerant of this horrible stigma attached to weed. And now we want to see it legalized.
All right. So are you saying now with your firm, the THC Legal Group in Cleveland, that if I'm a drug dealer, I sell weed, I just come to you and you spring me, give me bail or whatever whenever I get arrested? Is that how it works, or is there something else?
No, we are not criminal attorneys. So principally, the services that we offer are intellectual property services.
Intellectual property for weed?
Precisely. Or for products that are related to weed in some respect. So, for example, if you were an entrepreneur out in Colorado and you developed a brilliant lighting solution to help grow the plant in a way to maximize its fruit yield without burning it, you know, whatever the invention is that you've come up with, we would help you secure intellectual property protection for it in the form of a patent to make sure someone else could not steal your idea.
You can actually have patents for weed even though growing it's still illegal under federal law.
Right. Well, in this case, in the example that I just provided, the patent would not be for weed itself. It would be for some contraption that would facilitate the growth of weeds. But it's certainly true that, but, you know, the closer, as a general rule, the closer you get to the plant itself, the trickier and more precarious the legal status is of whatever you're trying to do. And that's certainly true with getting a trademark, for example.
How many trademarks or patents are there for weed right now in America?
Well, it depends what you mean by for weed. So do you mean...
you know what I mean, for weed. What primarily is used for weed? I mean, what are we talking about, 5, 10, 20? What are we talking about?
Well, there's only a handful of patents. This is an interesting discussion. There's a handful of patents for the actual new engineering of a strain of weed. This is kind of a hot thing right now. People are rushing to try to put in applications. But as far as patents for, like I just described, like a lighting system, you know, who knows? There could be an instant there. I would imagine a huge number. I mean, people developing products for agriculture that help it grow better. Soils, lights, different tools that help dig up, you know, whatever. So I would say a huge number.
Huh, son of a gun. I never would have thought. Tell me about this hot new thing about new strains of marijuana. Are we talking like GMO, Monsanto kind of stuff or what?
Well, so imagine if you were a chemist or a biologist, and you know you're excellent with herbs and other sorts of agriculture, and you start kind of genetically engineering new types of cannabis through different genetic modifications and other sorts of interesting scientific tools, you can actually cultivate a new strain of cannabis, of weed. And many people, of course, want to protect that new strain. So if you're the inventor of, let's call it Dizo Tequila, whatever, just some amazing new kind of weed that you just created, naturally you feel that you want to own that strain. So that particular field of patent protection is undoubtedly controversial and precarious, as I said. You know, how the federal government will relate to it, it's hard to know with any certainty. But there have been certain cases of people getting patents on strains of cannabis that they had designed and engineered.
That is amazing. It really is. What is the difference between medical marijuana and marijuana?
Sure. So the marijuana itself may or may not be different, you know, according to its potency, but really the central difference is that in a state where marijuana is commercially legal, you do not need to have a doctor's note saying that you are afflicted with a given illness or mental predicament in order to go and get it. You're just Joe Schmo. You want to buy some weed, and you can buy a certain amount, you know, under a certain limit, depending on the state.
Okay. How many states how many states do we have where marijuana is legal, where someone could just be smoking a joint or eating a brownie out in public?
Mm-hmm. So the number of states where it's just completely, fully, commercially legal, I think, you know, off the top of my head, less than 10, maybe 6 or 7, but there are far more states where it's medically legal. You know, medicinal marijuana is legal. And in total, I think we have about 20-some states where in one form or another you can access marijuana.
Okay, now medicinal marijuana, again, there's no difference in terms of the quality. If I needed medicinal marijuana in Ohio or Pennsylvania, West Virginia, whatever, assuming I could get it legally, the quality of it would be pretty much no different than what I could get from my dealer?
Yeah, I mean, without looking at, well, look, I mean, hopefully, no, I wouldn't say that. You know, one of the differences is that in states where there is some sort of legalization program, we do have more regulations. So presumably there will be a better quality assurance with the weed that you're getting from a qualified dispensary than, you know, if you were to just go on and your dealer, you know, your dealer is giving you something, you know, you don't really know what he's getting and where he's getting it from. Mm-hmm. Here, hopefully, presumably, there is kind of greater safety and security in the knowledge that it's better regulated.
All right. Now, you're in Ohio, and recently Ohio had a ballot measure that was going to legalize marijuana, but it was defeated overwhelmingly. And so I'm a little confused. Well, if it was defeated, then you're saying that Ohio is now going to be allowing marijuana?
Yeah, well, the ballot that you're talking about actually was about maybe a year or two ago. I can't quite remember. But the reason why it was defeated was because people were concerned that there were deeper issues of crony capitalism at play, that the people who were pushing it through, 11 key, you know, either people slash companies were going to effectively be in charge of the entire marijuana industry in Ohio. And people felt that was just going to destroy the marijuana community, and they didn't want to see that happen. They felt that everyone should have access to marijuana from a producer side. Everyone should be able to benefit from it economically. And the fact that these 11 people, companies, were going to have a monopoly over the industry, people found just repulsive, and they voted it down. Recently, in June, in fact, our governor, Kasich, he finally signed off a bill where marijuana would now be medically legal, medicinal marijuana, as we were talking about before. So starting sometime in mid-September, that's kind of the regimen that's going to be in Ohio.
Okay. Now, you're a lawyer, so you understand all about this legal stuff. Talk to me about some of the legal arguments. As a libertarian, I think it's immoral for the government to tell me what I can and cannot put in my body as long as I'm not harming someone else. But, you know, libertarians are, we're still in the minority, but someday we're going to, I do believe we're going to prevail. But in the meantime, you got to deal with these God-blessed laws trying to justify what is morally right. So legally, what's the strongest argument that you can use to say that the government has no business telling us whether we can or cannot use weed?
It's an interesting question. Basically, the way that the country is set up is that the highest law of the land is the Constitution. And the Constitution gives both individual rights in the form of amendments, and it gives the federal government rights, you know, according to different provisions in the Constitution. And then, of course, there are state rights. So really the question becomes, what happens when the federal government is trying to enact a certain power to do something where it's not explicitly permitted to do so under the Constitution? So in this case, the federal government says, for example, that cannabis is illegal. But, you know, naturally, you cannot open up the Constitution and find anything about cannabis or marijuana or weed. So, you know, where do they get this power to do that?
Right, right. Like any drug. Any drug. There's nothing that says anything about drugs.
That's true. So basically, what the government does is they look to different broader powers, and they see how those powers might apply to specific issues. So, for example, one of the ways that segregation was considered to be illegal, or, you know, the way the Civil Rights Act was passed in the mid-20th century, you know, nowhere does it say that white people and black people have to sit together in a restaurant, right? That's not anywhere in the Constitution, mm-hmm. certainly. And yet the government enacted a series of laws and said, no, that's illegal to racially segregate. So how did they do that? Well, it turns out that Congress looked to its commerce power, which it does have under the Constitution, and they said that this sort of de facto segregation is in fact hurting our interstate commerce. It's hurting our economy. And so under our broader commerce powers, we're allowed to regulate it. So similarly, in a more recent case with weed, in a famous case called Gonzales v. Reich, the government also determined, using its commerce powers, and people found this outrageous, but it was determined that a woman who is growing cannabis or weed in her backyard for her own personal use would inevitably impact commerce, the economy, in such a way that the government could once again invoke its commerce powers to stop her from growing it. And that was a seminal case. It was a very important case. And of course, that reaction that you had, many people had. What? Is this really affecting commerce in a meaningful, serious way?
Was this a Supreme Court decision?
Yes, Gonzalez v. Reich. I think I'm pronouncing her last name right, but yes, Gonzalez v. Reich.
Oh, man, this is so depressing. Yeah. Well, if they ruled on this then, Supreme Court has actually ruled on this, so what's to stop the next administration from saying, well, we're going to enforce the law and we already have the Supreme Court saying that you can't even grow pot in your backyard?
Right. Well, the Supreme Court ruling was more limited, as you just said. So it specifically kind of asked the question about whether or not you can grow pot in your backyard. It wasn't necessarily expansive enough to answer this bigger question of weed legality as a whole. But also, you know, there is this very interesting power dynamic between the Supreme Court saying something, Congress coming along and changing a law, and then seeing how those two actors kind of fight it out. So presumably, if in fact Congress were to pass serious reform in terms of its laws and hold that weed is going to be legal throughout the country, then that's what it will be.
This is insane. Another thing that drives me nuts is this thing, this law, or different laws, I guess, in different states, where now, for my listeners, they're going to think that I'm making this up, that it can't possibly be this bad. But it's my understanding. Again, you're the lawyer. You're Abe Cohn. You're the COO of the THC Legal Group. So you tell me if I have any idea of what the hell I'm talking about. But it's my understanding that depending on what state you're in, if you're driving around and the cops pull you over, oh, you've got a broken taillight, or you forgot to make a turn signal here, so we're pulling you over. Oh, I see you've got lots of cash in your car. We're going to take it. And they don't have to convict you of anything. They don't even have to effing charge you with anything. They just say, okay, we pulled you over. There's a lot of cash in your car. Now it's ours. Good luck getting it back. Do I essentially have that law understanding right?
It's a very complicated area of law. You know, there's something called civil forfeiture and criminal forfeiture, and how as you said, a specific legal question that is specific to the state that you are in. But the central idea the central cause for concern for many people, certainly many libertarians, is when the government or when the police officer is allowed to kind of designate his seizure as a civil seizure, as a criminal seizure. Honestly, I couldn't really speak too much about that off the top of my head. But the basic idea is that criminal activity, when you're engaging in criminal activity or perceived criminal activity, or if the cop thinks that there is enough evidence that there is criminal activity going on, you are forfeiting your right to some sort of aspect of that criminal activity, in this case, in the form of money or whatever material property it is.
Well, that sucks. Sucks. That's all there is to it. Now, okay, I'm not I don't care a whole lot about this whole abortion thing, about pro-choice, pro-life. I mean, I don't even like looking at the pictures. It's like, just Jesus, get away from me. But the one thing with this Roe v. Wade thing is about the courts somehow discovered that we have privacy rights, that even though it's not spelled out in the Constitution, just because it's not spelled out, we still have them, which, by the way, I agree with. But if we have privacy rights regarding an abortion, why don't we have privacy rights regarding smoking a joint?
It's an excellent question. Basically, the principle that those privacy rights was extracted from the Constitution was the 14th Amendment substantive due process rights. So the idea here is that under due process, what due process means in its simplest form is that if you were to be arrested and charged with a crime, the government cannot simply toss you in jail. First, they have to lay out a case against you. You have to be able to sit in front of a court and meet your challenger, the person who's accusing you of that crime. There has to be a judge who's impartial, who goes through a set of systems and rules to make sure that you're actually getting a fair trial. Then the punishment that you get has to fit the crime. You have to make sure that you're treated with due process, that you're treated fairly. So then at a certain, so that's kind of what it says in a very clear way in the Constitution and the 14th Amendment. Then at a certain point in time, certain Supreme Court justices found that not only is there what we just described as a procedural due process, a procedure to make sure that you're actually being treated fairly, but in fact, there are certain fundamental rights and liberties and privacies that as a citizen, you just naturally have.
Is that the 10th Amendment and the 9th Amendment? Is that what we're talking about now?
So that is the 14th Amendment, and it's called substantive due process. So the text of the Constitution says procedural due process, make sure you have a fair trial with witnesses, with the jury, with a proper prison sentence. That's procedural due process. And then Supreme Court justices have read into that same due process clause of the 14th Amendment an idea called substantive due process, where you actually have these fundamental liberties that you just simply have because you're an American. So as far as the abortion goes,
the privacy rights issue, yeah.
Yeah. So, right. So a privacy right is one of these fundamental liberties that the court reasoned you actually just flat out have as a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for the court to now deny you of that substantive due process right, one of these fundamental liberties, there must be a competing interest that can trump that initial right. So in the case of weed or cannabis, many people many people of the court, the legal system has found that there are other interests that are more important than you having the right to smoke weed. So in the Gonzales v. Reich case, like we talked about, that woman, Reich, you think she has a privacy right to grow weed in her backyard.
Right.
But the government came along and said, well, no, we have a more important interest at stake, which is regulating interstate commerce. That trumps her right.
Jesus.
Similarly, other competing interests that the government would invoke is their right to preserve the security of the state, of the country. So, yeah, it's true that you might have the right to smoke weed, but you smoking weed, so the argument goes, creates some sort of hazard and public safety concern, and the government has a right to squash your right in the interest of preserving that greater good. And that's kind of the argument.
My gosh. I said I could never be a lawyer because all these arguments against individual rights, I'd be telling the justices you're full of crap. And I don't think that would really work too well in front of oral arguments. But the Supreme Court, the way it is now, and even with Scalia, because Scalia was kind of a wild card when it came to individual liberties, individual rights. You weren't quite sure with him. Where is the court, the justices, are they all pretty much pro-big government, saying the federal government should really be trumping all of these states that are trying to allow people to smoke weed or grow weed or whatever peacefully? Or is there – what's the breakdown? What's the understanding of the court? Is it like the Democrat appointees are better with this or Republican appointees, or is it all mixed up? Or what's the
– Yeah.
What's it like there with the court today?
It's very interesting and convoluted, and it kind of splits on different issues. But as a general principle, more liberally oriented Supreme Court justices believe to a much larger extent in this idea of substantive due process rights. So gay marriage, for example, is just a classic example. There is certainly no provision in the Constitution or the 14th Amendment specifically, which is this equal protection clause. Everyone should be treated equally. You know, we don't really have any history or precedent to think that the Constitution would in any way entitle two gay people to get married, right?
Or straight people, for that matter. There's nothing in there about marriage, period.
That's exactly right. Which means that, and under the 10th Amendment, if there is nothing in the Constitution about a given thing, then it gets left up to the states.
Right.
So many people who are for gay marriage did not necessarily like that ruling, because you could be for gay marriage and want it to be decided on a state level,
right?
Not necessarily imposed on the rest of us by these Supreme Court justices.
So how does that apply to marijuana? Like the justices,
who
are the good ones when it comes to individual liberty, like for marijuana?
So interestingly, before, or I should say after Judge Scalia died, Colorado, or the neighboring states of Colorado, I think it was Nebraska and Oklahoma off the top of my head, this was maybe in the last 8 months, they wanted to bring a case against Colorado to the Supreme Court, saying that Colorado's marijuana legalization program is effectively creating this pollution of marijuana that's seeping over into the borders of these neighboring states of Nebraska and Oklahoma. I think those are the states. And the Supreme Court ultimately ruled that they wouldn't hear the case, that those states really did not have what's called standing to enter the court. Now, had Justice Scalia been alive when that question was brought before the court, he very likely would have been a swing vote and said, yeah, no, we do want to hear this case. And Justice Scalia very likely would have, or it's hard to know with certainty what he would have done. Many people suspect that he would have sided with those states, and it would have caused huge issues for the state of Colorado. So in that particular case, Justice Scalia, who many people think of as a more conservative slash libertarian judge, depending on how you look at the issues, he would not have been as good for marijuana. And that's a very interesting breakdown.
Who's the best on this issue, or is there one?
I don't think there's an answer to that necessarily. Wow. We haven't really seen. It would be hard to say.
All right. Now, walk me through.
Definitely liberal judges, I think, are better than conservative judges on this issue.
But liberal judges, I would think, are much more likely to prefer federal government control over states' rights.
That's true. But at the same time, they might want to see cannabis or marijuana brought into the fold on a federal level. So, liberals do want to see more federal control, but they might want to see federal control on a liberal issue. So same with gay marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to see gay marriage being instituted on a federal level.
All right. Fair enough. Now, give me an example. Okay, you're the chief operating officer, Abe Cohn, with the THC Legal Group in Cleveland. You're dealing with all these interesting issues regarding the marijuana or cannabis business. And you've got trademarks and patents and all this other stuff. What is the most interesting client or the case that you've had that you could point to and go, you know, this ABC weed company in Ohio or Colorado or whatever hired us to do this really interesting thing or these really interesting things. Here's what we did. Give me a best example of some really wild, crazy, interesting thing that you did for a company whose business is weed.
Right. Well, I certainly don't want to name any specific company.
No, it's okay. It's okay. You can mention the names. It's all right. I have no problem with that. Go ahead.
I will say, you know, company XYZ, as you said. Company XYZ. Well, okay. Well, one of the more interesting challenges, kind of circling back to what we talked about in the beginning of the conversation, is this weird dynamic where the federal law says X, state law says Y, they're butting heads, and now a company wants to use some sort of legal protection, and how does the federal law, how does that interact with this dilemma? And that's kind of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly tricky for questions of trademarks. So a trademark is just a source identifier. Think of the Nike swoosh. You look at a tennis shoe, it has a swoosh on it, and in your own mind, you say, oh, Nike must have made that. It must be X quality, right?
Yeah.
Now, so imagine if a new startup shoe company were to come along and they were to take that exact same Nike swoosh and put it on their shoe. The reason that they would do that, of course, is because they also want people to think in that brief moment of consumer consideration that Nike must be behind that shoe that this startup had just made.
Mm-hmm.
And now that consumer is more likely to buy it because they think that Nike was, in fact, the creator of it.
Hmm.
So trademark law is meant to prevent this sort of cynical freeloading. Trademark law doesn't want people to be able to steal other people's logos, insignias, names, plaster them on their products in order to steal them. Okay.
All right.
So, but with trademark law, one of the more challenging issues is that the good that's being sold that you're attaching this trademark to has to be a legal good. So with cannabis, for example, and trademarks are governed for the most part on a federal level, but not necessarily, cannabis, as we said, is still illegal. So how could it be that you could go about getting a trademark on a good that's illegal?
Right, right, right.
That's the question. That's the fundamental question.
Well, how do you do it?
So in order to do it, there are really two different strategies. One, the first thing is to recognize that the closer you get to the weed itself, if you actually want to get a trademark on a name of a new strain of cannabis, that is pretty much completely impossible.
Mm-hmm.
If, however, imagine now you were a dispensary, and this is a strategy we recommend to different clients. If you were a dispensary, you could also provide a different good. So, for example, let's say your dispensary was called Cano Love Spot.
Mm-hmm.
You could start creating t-shirts, putting your logo Cano Love Spot on those t-shirts, selling them, and then register a trademark for that name, attaching it to the product of a t-shirt. And then that would kind of cover all of the other things that you're doing within the space, including the weed itself. So that's one strategy, and it's an important strategy.
Yeah,
And then alternatively, if you wanted to get a trademark specifically on the strain and you were in a state where it's legal, you could get a statewide trademark.
Well, that would only be for that state, though, right?
For that, exactly. It would only be for that state.
All right, so let's say I came up with Abe's super-duper weed in Colorado. Uh-huh. It's a certain strain of weed that's like the best marijuana that, you know, that's ever been grown or whatever
right.
It happens to be. But you could only use that name legally in Colorado. And if somebody in Ohio, for example, used that name, some street dealer or whatever, there was really nothing you could do about that. Is that right?
Right. That's exactly right.
That sucks. That sucks.
A trademark is really just a right to sue. It's a piece of paper saying, I own this. You're now using my thing. I have the right to sue you.
Well, how's that different from a service mark?
Sure. A service mark really is just it's not different. A service mark is just a more precise way of identifying what the mark covers. So if you were an accountant and you're super duper accountant, your service mark would designate a service that you're providing.
Hmm.
Whereas traditionally trademarks are thought of being attached to goods or products,
mm-hmm,
instead of services, like the Nike Swish we talked about.
Hmm. Well, mine, I've got a trademark thing I always use for my the way that I bill myself is the lovable libertarian, three words, lovable libertarian. That would be a trademark. I always put a TM there next to it so nobody takes it. That's pretty good, right?
Well, I think that's a great name, first of all. But a mark only becomes a, quote, trademark once it's actually being used in commerce. So if you're not actually attaching your mark to a good or service that you are selling in interstate commerce,
That's my show. I say I'm the lovable libertarian.
Right. Well, but are you selling anything?
Well, sometimes T-shirts.
Oh, okay. So there you go.
Oh, okay. Fair enough then.
So
all right.
The sale of the good to which the mark is attached is what kind of completes the circle and makes it so that it is, in fact, a bona fide trademark.
Oh, okay. Great. Any other really interesting clients you have or had that had a really interesting problem that your THC firm solved? Because it's really a whole new field. I can't imagine there are all that many law firms specializing in this, because it's so new and it's so Wild West type and all that.
Right, right. You know, we did have one client. This is actually very interesting. Mm-hmm. He developed a product. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but basically he developed a product, and there were many different, let's call them flavors of that one product, or many different types of that product.
Marijuana, different types of marijuana.
Not marijuana.
Really?
An auxiliary service. I don't want to say what, but you know, just the product and
papers. Flavored papers, right?
Call them flavored papers. and the analogy which we gave him, which I'd be happy to share with you, which I think is quite good, is to think of the Ben & Jerry brand. So when you look at a Ben & Jerry tub of ice cream, the logo is the same, of course. The general kind of artistic structure of the wrapper is the same. But nevertheless, each tub is a different flavor, and so there are different colors, different names on it. And you can imagine with a brand like Ben & Jerry's, there are so many different flavors. It would be crazy for them to try to get to register a, quote, trademark, or in this case, a trade dress for each one of those flavors. And this company, you know, a startup company in the cannabis space, it didn't have a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. Naturally, they too could not afford, nor would they necessarily want to try to register protection for each one of those wrappers on their product.
Mm-hmm.
So we just helped them figure out. So,
well, how did you do it?
So the idea there. So we talked about trademarks and we talked about trade services. This additional category in the trade family is called a trade dress, where you're actually getting a protection on kind of the totality of the image. So if you just imagine, again, the Ben & Jerry's tub of ice cream, you look at it, doesn't matter which flavor you're looking at, they all have enough, they have an artistic continuity throughout each one of them. Mm-hmm. That when you just look at one, you know that it's all Ben & Jerry's, right?
Right.
So what are the artistic elements involved for an individual to process in their minds that this thing belongs to the Ben & Jerry brand? So that is the thing. The totality of these different elements and kind of design structures are what allows Ben & Jerry's to claim, quote, trade dress, the dress, this entire thing.
It's sort of the artwork and the font and all that. That's pretty much what you're trademarking then.
Exactly. Kind of this whole thing, you know, this image that tells a story to the consumer. Huh. It's that kind of distinct image. So, you know, imagine if you were to walk into Starbucks. There are probably 10,000 Starbucks in the United States alone. Who knows how many, right?
There are that many just in Cleveland, come to think of it.
Maybe just in Cleveland.
Yeah.
But no matter where you go, they all look identical, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have the same color woods, the same style of cushions on their couches, the same artwork. So imagine if a new coffee shop were to open up and design it to look exactly like Starbucks.
Hmm.
Clearly, you know, our intuition would tell us that there's something not fair about that, right?
Right.
And so trademark law also recognizes that there's something not fair about that. And so what Starbucks actually has claimed to is, quote, the trade dress of that design layout of this store.
Hmm. Okay.
You know, this kind of totality of elements and structures, you know, the things that create a story in the person's mind when they look at something. That's the trade dress.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
And similarly, yeah, and with our client, we really helped them kind of we help them distill down their own unique artistic vision and develop a really solid design strategy for their trade dress.
Are there really that many clients out there for your business?
There are a lot. Huge number. It's a booming industry.
Yeah.
You know, recently I was at the Javits Center in New York City, and I remember, I'm not sure if any of your listeners, it was my first time there, but it's one of the biggest convention centers in maybe even the world. And I walked down this escalator into this cavernous space, and there was just rows of cannabis businesses, And it was just an amazing sight, just a huge display of serious businessmen and players in the space.
Wow.
who were just in the industry, and it was amazing.
Wow. Who was the strangest, the sketchiest, the dodgiest, the freakiest client that you ever had? I'm guessing somebody from Jamaica, but was there like one person who had like tats and piercings and dreadlocks and whatever, and you went, no, we don't want his business that badly? Was there one person?
Right. No, we did not have that. I will say that we have had people who have offered to barter with us, and they wanted to pay us in weed. And, of course, that is not something we have any interest in doing.
Okay, that's the official line you're going with. All right, I'll back you on that. But was there one person that came to you and you're going, oh, my God, we can't be dealing with this guy and whatever. Who was it?
Well, yeah, this particular gentleman, you know, he was clearly, who offered to pay us in weed, he was clearly a less than savory individual. he seemed like a street hustler.
Okay.
Just kind of your archetype image of what a drug dealer would be like. Who is this guy?
Oh,
and he had
God.
Some idea which was completely nonsensical.
Like what?
And
what
beyond
was,
that,
No. Don't bury the lead. What was the nonsensical idea?
I don't want to go into
Come on. He's not your client, so who cares? What was the idea?
I don't want to really go into it. It involved prostitution and a new way of connecting the prostitution industry and the weed industry. Let's just put it like that.
Nice.
But beyond that, he wanted to pay us in weed, which was an amazing proposition.
Jesus. I love this. Oh, my goodness. I could listen to you all afternoon. I swear to God. Anyway, well, look, A-Buck, Colin, you've been a terrific guest. You're Operating Officer of the THC Legal Group, a law practice specializing in the cannabis industry. How interesting is that? And in Cleveland, of all places, the East Side, no less. So good for you. Anyway, I always give my guests the last word here at One Dimitri Radio. So this is your opportunity to speak directly with my listeners, to either repeat key points or bring up new points, and also to shamelessly promote your books, your speaking engagements, your websites, your anything and everything. So, Abe Cohen, my Shure SM7B dynamic microphone is yours.
Okay, well, maybe I can do both of those things. So, you know, the first thing I would just like to say, I think this will resonate with your libertarian audience. You know, we're often asked, you know, what do we tell people? Clients will say, what do we tell people who ask us, oh, you really want to be a part of the weed industry? You want to make weed legal? You want to bring weed into the country? You want to destroy our communities? You know, this is a question that we get, and people who speak to us just have to deal with this kind of harassment all the time. And then what I like to tell our clients is that they should kindly ask those people to kind of reverse the question and ask them, oh, do you really want to be throwing people in jail? Do you want to be flooding our prison systems with people who are smoking weed? And so when you look at it that way, it really gives cause for concern. And people stop and think and say, well, yeah, maybe I don't like it. The point is not whether or not the individual enjoys weed himself, but whether or not he wants the government to not only tell him he can't enjoy weed, but that the government is going to now throw them in jail for using it. And I think that's just an important message and something that people should really keep in mind. Don't ask yourself if you like weed. Ask yourself if you want the government telling you you can't enjoy weed. And then, you know, we love hearing from people with interesting stories and interesting ideas. We've worked with some amazing clients. And I'd like to welcome all of your audience to please visit our website, www.thclegalgroup.com. We have an amazing resource center up there that's being continuously updated with new content for entrepreneurs and startup companies looking to get into the cannabis industry, with some great advice and just some easy to read articles and content that'll kind of get you in the game. Of course, please feel free to email us info@thclegalgroup.com. We're on YouTube. YouTube THC Legal Group. And if you want to follow us in real time, our Twitter handle is THC_group.
Fantastic. Abe Cohn, you're a terrific guest. A really intriguing idea here. And I wish you continued success with all of this. And I'm sure we'll get you back on soon with the latest updates regarding this whole insane war on drugs and all that stuff. So I hope you have a great day and enjoy the weekend. And we'll be talking with you again soon. Okay.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure being on the show.